This morning I'll be reading Ajahn Buddhadasa from his book Key to Natural Truth, and this particular talk is translated by Ajahn Santikaro, and it's called The Dhamma Truth of Samatha Vipassana for the Nuclear Age. Lecture at Suen Mok, 31st of March, 1984. This is the 12th and final talk of the series Samatha Vipassana for the Nuclear Age. I would like to use this opportunity today to summarize in one bird's eye view every angle and aspect of the topics discussed during this series. My goal is to go clearly and penetratingly into each of them one by one. I call this Dhamma Satcha, Dhamma Truth, by which I mean that a specific aspect or angle must be scrutinized until we realize, on the most profound level, exactly what its true nature is. Most importantly, Dhamma Satcha is the one particular truth most appropriate and necessary for a situation and its circumstances. We must choose the Dhamma Truth that needs to be studied and realized here and now. For this scrutiny, I'll use the framework of the Four Noble Truths, which consists of the principles: what is it? Through what cause does it arise? What is its purpose? How does it succeed in that purpose? Today's talk is called The Dhamma Satcha of Samatha Vipassana for the Nuclear Age. The nuclear age form of Dhamma prepares all people to face the events of our nuclear era, events of war and events of peace. It also prepares us for the general events in the daily lives of human beings. In the case of war, if nuclear war occurs, what sort of Dhamma will enable the mind to face such horrible dangers and punishment? With peace, what knowledge is needed regarding this situation in which there is still this nuclear age kind of peace? As for Buddhists, in order to be true Buddhists who don't waste the opportunity of hearing the Dhamma, what do we need to know about this matter, and how should we practice to protect our name, face, and honor? Don't forget that being a Buddhist means being one who knows, is awakened, and has blossomed into perfection. Nowadays, what are people doing that we call this the nuclear age? They can go up to the moon, circle it, land on it, and come back to Earth. They can send vehicles to look at it, explore, and go beyond the planets. Nothing is at all like the old days. We can jump from here to there and fly around the world in hours. Things have changed like this. Now that we can go to the heavens, nothing is the same. What mental qualities, then, are appropriate for a mankind that has progressed in this direction and to this degree? Obviously, this kind of progress leads to strange and powerful results. In Dhamma language, we call these results Atimahantaramana, Ati extreme, Mahanta great, Aramana things known or felt, things which strike or make contact. They are sense objects that powerfully strike the mind in the form of dukkha. Why don't we take a happier view of the situation? Because that's impossible. Material progress that leads people to be infatuated with sensual pleasure and stimulation blocks the way to peace. Even though we may be enjoying some delicious sensual pleasures now, such sense experiences support and increase the defilements, especially the defilement of selfishness. With selfishness reaching extreme levels, there's no peace in sight. Therefore, we can see only these undesirable things that we have created. There are tragedies, disasters, and crises, the opposites of peace. They come one after another without any pause between them, and so we call them Atimahantaramana. This is a strange word for ordinary people, but it is normal in Dhamma language. Huge, extreme sense objects dominate the mind completely, and their impact is beyond reckoning. Small objects come and go without having any meaning and are forgotten. When objects are large and extreme, however, they're difficult to forget. They're oppressive and destructive, and they cause much dukkha. Also, they have the characteristic of another word from Dhamma language, amata puti kapaya, danger that makes one parentless. The danger we're discussing here is amata putika. It's so great that not even our parents can rescue us. It's so vast that we can't help our parents either. No one can be of help to anyone else. Normally, this word applies only to the dukkha that arises out of birth, aging, illness, and death, in which children can't help their parents and parents are unable to help their children. This is an enormous and absolute danger. And now there is an external danger of the same magnitude, where parents and children can't help each other, which leaves us completely alone. Close your eyes and think about it. If a nuclear missile comes down, who is going to help who? We'll all be dust anyway. Who can help who? This peril is of the same proportion and meaning as the words, "We can't help each other in the matters of birth, aging, illness, and death." In this nuclear age, such dangers can come at any time. Although we may have parents and children, it's as if we had no one. Then who will help us? What will help? I think that Dhamma will help us, which means the Buddha will help us. Therefore, we must develop and store Dhamma that will help us in circumstances so dangerous that thousands of mothers or children would be of no help. To prepare yourself so that you won't cry is enough. Don't go so far as to prepare yourself to laugh. No one would believe you. Simply being prepared not to cry when disaster comes is splendid enough. You don't have to say that you'll laugh. Actually, if one really has a lot of this sort of Dhamma, I think that one could laugh. Someone with a sufficiently high level of Dhamma can laugh in all events, whether disastrous or beneficial. One could laugh at both matters that encourage liking and that encourage disliking. However, we common folk needn't go so far. We only need, for as long as we haven't died, not to cry. That's plenty good already. Thus, I encourage you to listen to this Dhamma of Samatha Vipassana for the nuclear age, so that you'll be skillful, expert, and correct in its practice. Then you'll remain unperturbed during the enormous changes of the nuclear age. You must think back to the topics of the 11 previous talks. From the beginning, how are we to practice each one? Of them, which point is the most important? Realize anicchang, dukkhang, and anatta. Realize sunyata, voidness or selflessness, tattata, thusness, and then itapachayata, conditionality. Penetrate to these realizations with every exhalation and inhalation. That's the most important issue. How much is accomplished in practicing on such a level? If one fully sees that it's only thus, it's only such, whenever something, no matter how enormous, arises, if tattata is seen, that's how to endure and how to remain still. Then, if you want, you'll be able to laugh. But the arhants probably wouldn't waste energy on useless laughter. Remaining quiet and still is better, without laughing, without crying. That's what's best, having Dhamma that keeps one calm and quiet in all circumstances. Allow me, then, to explain point by point what it is, where it comes from, what its purpose is, and the method for achieving that purpose. Before we discuss the meaning of Samatha Vipassana for the nuclear age, we must understand why the word nuclear is used here. In using it, I don't mean that we must all be scientists who study the theories of nuclear chemistry and physics in all their complexity and detail. It isn't necessary for us to be scientists like that. We only need to know that nothing can act clumsily or hesitantly and still survive in this nuclear era. All things must be like lightning bolts in their arising, in their ceasing, and in their knowledge of other things. All things must be as fast as lightning bolts. They must be deeper than the ocean and strike like lightning bolts so that nothing can resist. In just the same way, our acts must accord with the nuclear age. This need for speed and power is what is meant by nuclear. When we say Samatha Vipassana for the nuclear age, we ought to realize the significance of joining the words Samatha and Vipassana together. Samatha Vipassana is one thing, not two separate things. If they were two things, we would have to do two things, and that would be too slow. When tranquility and insight are united as one thing, there is only a single thing to do. Both Samatha and Vipassana are developed at one and the same time. That saves time. Precious commodity in this nuclear age. Let's review the method of practice that was discussed in the previous talks. When we look at something, we endeavor to see how it truly is, both the characteristics that it has and its deepest reality or truth. In short, when seeing or watching anything, One will see the state of idha pachayata, the activity of causes and conditions endlessly forming and concocting each other. As I've summarized this before, sitting right here and looking all around us, we will see nothing but the flow of idha pachayata that is concocting and being concocted. It flows continuously according to impermanence and the fact that once conditions have formed, they force the arising of new things and more new things. We can describe this as simultaneously seeing with tranquility, samatha, seeing an object and fixing the mind upon it, and seeing with insight, vipassana, seeing the characteristics, conditions, and truth of the thing. These two kinds of seeing happen together. We can say that samadhi is added to panya. Samadhi is the mind steadfastly focusing on the object. Panya is seeing what the thing is about, what characteristics it has, and what its truth is. For example, to look at and fix on a stone is samadhi. Then to see that this stone is flowing continuously in change is panya. You don't have to do it many times. You don't need to do it twice. Once is enough. Watch the stone and bring concentration and wisdom together in that watching. This illustrates the intelligence of the Zen Buddhists. They don't separate samadhi and panya. Rather than distinguishing between the two, both together are called Zen. In Pali, the word is jhana, and in Sanskrit, it is dhyana, which means to gaze, to stare. Therefore, stare into that thing and see it with both concentration and wisdom. We can see that the Zen sect doesn't distinguish between morality, concentration, and wisdom. When we stare at something, there is morality in that gazing. Then fixing on that thing is samadhi, and seeing its reality is wisdom. It saves a lot of time to combine three things into one. Yet practicing this one thing yields three kinds of fruit. Maybe we'll be forced to admit that it's stupid to separate morality, concentration, and wisdom from one another than to practice them one at a time. There's never been any success in doing so. One can uphold morality until death, yet never have morality. It is impossible to fulfill any of the trainings when they are separated from one another. There's no use intending to practice sila without knowing why and how to practice bunya. Actually, we practice morality to support concentration and practice concentration to support wisdom. If we separate them and do only one, there's no chance of success. Therefore, do all three together simultaneously. In this way, there is success. There's a Zen picture that I'd like to discuss. I think it will amuse you. It's a picture of a frog sitting at the mouth of its hole. I'm not very familiar with it, but I've seen it a few times. The frog is sitting at the mouth of its hole. It's sitting in the meditation posture. The words accompanying the picture are the frogs. If they're perfected ones only because they sit in the meditation posture a lot, then I'm a perfected one, an arhat as well, because I've been sitting meditation all my life. The frog says it has sat in meditation from its birth until the present. The Zen people are teasing other sects, kidding both other Mahayana sects and Theravadins as well, for attaching to sitting meditation, for trying to sit in concentrated states until they become rigid, stiff, and crusty. The frog teases them, saying, I've sat in meditation all my life, therefore I'm an arhat, just like the others. This points out something important. Don't practice anything blindly, without examining it from all sides in all aspects. There's another picture that teases in the same way. In this one, the frog says, these guys are accomplished and successful. If they pass this way, I'll jump into the water with a loud plop and scare them out of their wits. Have these accomplished Vipassana teachers walk past this way, and I'll jump into the water with a noisy plop to startle them. This pokes fun at those who attach so much to an activity that they preach, do only this, do just this. Then they attach so much to any success that it becomes magical and holy, something that never existed in Buddhism. Always remember that Buddhism has never had anything to do with magical and holy matters. Don't drag them in. There's only idha pachayata. Everything follows the law of conditionality directly and absolutely. There's no way for it to be anything magical or holy. If you don't realize this, little things like a frog's plop will continue to frighten you. If we bring magical and sacred things into Buddhism, It will become just more bowing to and worshiping holy things, requesting whatever we want without doing anything. That's a religion of begging and pleading. That isn't Buddhism at all. Instead, we must behave and practice in correct accordance with the law of nature. Then benefits will progress according to that practice. We can see in the Dhammapada commentaries, which are full of stories, that the Buddha once gave his disciples a certain meditation object. He gave them a particular matter to take into individual practice and instructed them to come to tell him if any results that occurred. The Buddha didn't sit watch over the monks as is done with people nowadays, nor did he distinguish that is concentration and this is insight. He gave them a meditation object very similar to a Zen koan to think about. No, not to think about, but to guard until they saw clearly. For example, they were to practice in a way that was neither here nor elsewhere, without past, without present, without future. They were to practice until the feeling of, quote, not being here and not having gone anywhere, unquote, arose. In being here, there is yet a self, some person that is here. In having gone, there is the desire to go somewhere. There is craving to find something else, something, somewhere. And there's no past, no present, no future, because these are all identical. If we are just free of craving, that's all it takes. Past, future, and present have no meaning. This is what the Buddha meant, but instead of explaining the meditation in this way, he had the monks figure it out on their own. He had them meditate until they saw there is no past, no future, and no present, and there's no being anywhere, no nor going somewhere. Nothing going, nothing coming, and nothing stopping anywhere. Figure it out yourself. The monks did as they were instructed, and as soon as they began to contemplate what the Buddha had given them, there was morality, concentration, and wisdom full to the brim. The self-control to do a certain thing is morality. Pouring the mind's power into that thing is concentration. Clearly seeing and brightly knowing in successive understandings is wisdom or insight. As soon as the monks applied themselves to scrutinizing the matter that had to be understood, sila, samadhi, and panya arose. They didn't chant through any rituals about the 10 precepts or the 227 precepts. Collecting the power of the body and mind into scrutinizing one certain thing, that collecting is sila, the looking is samadhi, and the seeing of the truth is that thing is panya vipassana. The commentaries make it very clear that in his time the Buddha gave meditation objects the scrutiny of which led to both tranquility and insight. He didn't separate practice into different stages to be done one at a time until we die without actually having practiced anything, such as keeping sila all one's life without ever having sila. Be very careful about this. Things that are genuinely successful and beneficial become small, simple matters, not the complicated elaborations of our modern thinking and attachment. I'd like to ask you to observe the way things are naturally. When we think or do anything, the idea and intention to act, and then the intention to do, is as well as possible, are gathered together within the act itself. We are able to survive in this life and can win the struggle with nature because nature creates living things that have the intention to act and act correctly within themselves. But because this happens gradually, we don't see it clearly and can't make out the distinctions. If we observe the children running around, we'll see that they develop daily in both samadhi and panya. Have a small child write the ABCs, she'll improve daily. This shows that there is samadhi developing daily in her writing and there is growing intelligence in her ability to write more beautifully. Can't you see it? Meditation and wisdom work together and develop together until, before long, the child is able to write quickly and beautifully, that is, successfully. There is nothing that can be done without the simultaneous application of the powers of mind and wisdom. No matter how stupid a person is, if we give him an axe and tell him to cut some wood, and then he returns with the wood, then there must be samadhi, and panya present. Any fool who can cut wood successfully must have concentration to chop down with the axe and wisdom to know how and where to chop so that the wood splits properly. It doesn't take a teacher to do it. In the chopping of wood, concentration and wisdom develop to the appropriate and necessary degree. All natural things are under the control of nature itself. Sila in woodcutting means the intention to cut wood and to not wander off to play halfway through the work. Steadiness in the chopping and intelligence in knowing how to do it in a simple way are samadhi and panya. This natural concentration and wisdom is present in everything. Even a cook boiling rice or making curries in her kitchen demonstrates mindfulness and wisdom, satipanya, steadiness of mind and careful control of things. Without these qualities, she couldn't cook anything. She couldn't even light the fire without both concentration and wisdom. Yet this is all natural and according to nature. Also, it's so subtle that you won't realize it if you don't carefully observe and study it. However, it isn't necessary to study this because anyone can cut wood. Any fool can light a fire. With no exceptions, nature brings concentration and wisdom together in all things. This is something that nature has ordained all along, so that this partnership is a matter of nature which proceeds naturally. Consequently, we have the skill, cleverness, promptness, and resourcefulness needed to survive only because adequate samadhi and panya are available. Whether an animal is about to sting us, bite us, or claw us to death, or we've fallen down, or whatever danger might happen, it is necessary to rectify that situation in order to survive. That survival requires concentration and wisdom that are naturally sufficient. Such is the goodness of nature that it gives us half a chance. If we step into a fire, the leg will immediately pull back without any conscious mental intention. This is an area in which nature helps a great deal. But should it be impossible to pull the leg back, to remove the foot from the fire, then there must be the knowledge, the mindfulness and wisdom, the problem-solving ability, the something needed to survive. I've observed that even animals have these faculties, although to a less evolved degree than people. They have the intention to act, and then they act well enough to succeed. For a snake to swallow an animal as big as itself takes concentration and wisdom. Sit down and watch for one. A snake can swallow up something as big as itself. Nature requires that we have both samadhi and panya, and it provides us with both, only we don't bother to use them. We're careless, proud, overconfident, stupid, or whatever, so that we don't bother to make full and proper use of concentration and wisdom. If we take a purely material example, one that has nothing to do with people, in which there's a kind of awareness and thought that accords with natural law, we can see that more than one thing is necessary to achieve success and benefit. Let's take another look at the axe used for cutting wood. For the axe to bite into the wood, it must have two qualities, sharpness and weight. It can't be light, but it must have sufficient weight. Sharpness alone, as with a razor blade, can't do the work. Nor would a heavy but dull axe work. A hammer is useless for chopping wood. For an axe or any cutting tool to perform properly, it must have both weight and sharpness. Samadhi is the weight that provides the power to chop, and panya is the sharpness that cuts into the wood. Both qualities are needed. This example of an axe and its function is merely physical, yet both concentration and wisdom are required. Nobody, however, is interested in these things. If you were to study from the lowest levels of nature, you'd probably understand this matter. In general, we blur the two qualities into one. We don't know about the realities that deceive us. We don't catch the deceptive facts. Take, for example, a slide projected onto a screen. We think it's a picture on the screen. We don't know that it's composed of two most important factors, light of adequate strength, and a slide that is projected by that light. If we turned on the light without the slide, the screen would be all white. There would be just the light component. When we put a slide in front of the light, it appears as a picture on the screen and we see the picture. We don't see the light because we already see it as a picture. We only see the picture on the screen. We never distinguish between the light as one component and the slide as another component, both of which must work together. This is the cause of our inability to distinguish the samadhi component and the panya component as two separate qualities. The powerful light which shines upon the screen is the equivalent of concentration, and the different pictures carried by the light are like wisdom. We think reality is a picture on the screen. This is the fool's reality. Wise people realize that there are two things at work, sufficient light and a clear slide. Add one to the other and they come together on the screen. Thus, wise people realize that the picture on the screen is impermanent, insubstantial, and not a soul, self, or eternal entity, that it is compounded of two components, light and slide. We ought to know and remember that things are compounded of at least two important components in order for them to appear as something with any meaning or value. Things work the same way when we see a car drive by. We only see the car driving past us. We never think to distinguish the two components, the engine that creates power and the wheels that spin by the strength of that engine. These are different components, as all mechanics well know. In the language of mechanics, they say that if there's no load, the motor spins without doing work. In other words, if the engine isn't engaged with the drive shaft, the motor spins like crazy to no purpose. Samadhi is the power. If it is put in gear and connected by the drive mechanism to something, then that thing will move accordingly. For example, when a car runs or a generator produces electricity, we don't distinguish the two prominent features, the two important aspects that are twined together, namely, the energy produced by the motor and the mechanism that converts the energy into motion or some other visible effect. There are two parts, but we always see it as a single thing. We only see the car go by. When we look at rice mills, elevators, and traffic lights, we only see some contraption doing some strange activity. You ought to observe that the power aspect is concentration, and the activity aspect is knowledge and wisdom. This is only natural. Even inanimate things must have these two components, samadhi and panya. I've spent all this time on this point to help you realize that for success in anything, both factors must be present. Concentration or tranquility is the force or power needed, and insight or wisdom is the action that is required by the circumstances. Now it's clear that samadhi and panya can't be separated, and that sila is a junior partner or assistant that must always be in tow. Within any action there is morality, because that action must keep itself even and in order. Hence, morality, concentration, and wisdom are revealed in the secret nature that all success comes through sila, samadhi, and panya. Concentration is the energy, wisdom is action in line with an objective, and morality is the foundation that allows action to proceed smoothly. You should thank sila, samadhi, and panya, these profound and hidden principles which we never observe or realize. I hope that you will observe and realize them. In addition to that, I want you to improve them and perfect them to be appropriate for the nuclear age. Now we'll take a purely dhammic view. Observe that when various problems arise, dukkha in particular, there also must be solutions for them. All solutions must be complete in certain necessary qualities. The same is true of what we call the Noble Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path that we've memorized so well. Generally, we take only the quick, superficial view of recognizing that's the Eightfold Path, just as when we see a car go past, but don't see the various systems at work within it. The larger system of the Eightfold Path contains hidden subsystems within it. These are the morality subsystem of right speech, right action, and right maintenance of life, the concentration subsystem of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, and the wisdom subsystem of right view and right intention. In the Noble Eightfold Path, in those eight factors, there are sila, samadhi, and panya operating as integrated components that make the whole system work. Having no sila is like lacking any ground to stand on. To have no samadhi is to lack energy and strength, and to have no panya is to lack the sharpness needed to cut through problems. You would do well to remember that concentration and wisdom must join together and work together without any separation. So it seems that the Zen people are actually quite skillful in using the single term Zen to mean both concentration and wisdom working together. If we don't think carefully about this, we'll remain stupid. If we do think carefully about it, we'll admit that their improvement, just Zen, to cover sila, samadhi, and panya, is true and correct. We don't need to be frogs sitting in frogs' meditation and becoming arhants at the mouths of our holes. That's how things will end up if we make such separations. Here we practice morality, concentration, and wisdom together. We Buddhists have Noble Eightfold Path as a fundamental tenet. In it, morality, concentration, and wisdom are fully present. We must realize the fact that these three components must be intertwined, just as a three-ply rope has three strands twisted into one usable rope. Now, if someone asks, "So what's this Samatha Vipassana for the nuclear age?" we'll answer, "The system of practice that completely accords with natural principles that yields the best, the fastest, and the most complete results in order to be abreast of any situation." Some people will then ask, "If that's true, then isn't the Buddha's teaching enough?" If they're blindly going to ask questions like this, it isn't necessary to answer. The Buddha's teachings are sufficient, more than enough, but his followers are stupid. They don't apply the teachings fully or quickly. They must be up to every situation, and in time, if they're going to catch the sparks before the nuclear fire erupts. What the Buddha taught is adequate for the nuclear age. It's quick and complete enough for any age. His followers are sluggish, however, and sometimes they split the teachings into so many pieces that it's impossible to do anything right. Rather than spinning everything into a single theme, they unravel it into more threads than can be followed. Whether this is stupid or wise, you can see for yourselves. If a person took three ropes, then unraveled them into many strands in order to tether a water buffalo, what a mess it would be. How stupid to have things become. If it takes one three-ply rope to tether a buffalo properly, how could we tether that same buffalo with just a single strand from that same rope after we've unraveled it? This point must be scrutinized until we see that the Buddha said all that needs to be said. Svaghato Bhagavata Dhammo. The Dhamma has been explained perfectly by the Exalted One. It's completely successful already, but we don't act correctly in this matter. I'm afraid that if we allow this clumsiness to continue, there will be nothing left for us to use in the nuclear age, because it demands absolute correctness, perfection, and speed. Excellence in everything. This is the reason that I'm giving this series of lectures, entitled Samatha Vipassana for the Nuclear Age.
For a lot of people, that I mean, 1984 was that whole era was one of a lot of incredible amount of fear, particularly in Europe, but that was translated globally. And that's one of the reasons why, say, Amar Bhante is named Amar Bhante, because there was so much. That was 1983, 1984, that Amar Bhante was established. And John Sumedho chose that name because there was this constant concern and worry. And you had the political leaders, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, were the leaders of sanity. So that wasn't very comforting. And particularly in Europe and Britain was all of the cruise missiles were America-based in Britain to be the buffer. So it wasn't very comforting for people in Europe.
Directed to essentially survival of genes and propagation of ideas. That's what it does if you just let it go and don't do anything about it. But I just, and so in some ways what we're doing in practice is taking those skills and trying to figure out, okay, given this set of stuff, how do I move this over to find the cessation of suffering, instead of trying to propagate my genes and spread my ideas. And I was curious, is it that See, does that come up?
Or
he talked about the Eightfold Path at the end, which I thought addressed that pretty well.
Yeah, I think that's a in terms of view, which is leading the path, and that's the you're looking at purpose and function. So that and the purpose is purpose and function always come back to the alleviation of suffering. And the relinquishment of self-view.
It seemed to me a little bit too, it's like he used a lot of analogies, but it's like tapping into faculties that we have in our nature in order to tackle the problem of dukkha, rather than taking dukkha and making it hopelessly complicated so that we're not able to tackle it. Like you
well, I think that that's in terms of, the takeaway bit of the forest teachers or ethos is that, we have everything within us and learning how to apply it skillfully. I mean, that's the takeaway bit of the winter retreat. And, they're coming at it from all sorts of different angles, but there's this the underlying kind of thread that theme of relying on our and refining our capabilities that we actually have. Sila, Samadhi, Panya are not external to us.
A question of meditation about that's been in my mind for a little while of just wondering if you'd be willing to offer any advice on discerning between useful sitting meditation and being lost in the fog of dullness and drowsiness and working with that distinction.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, at any time when the hindrances are overwhelming one, there isn't a when one's sitting, and there isn't a fairly clear way through it, then there's it's important to. Because the actual, the act of sitting in the meditation posture doesn't necessarily mean that it's fruitful. It's like similar to what Ajahn Buddhadasa sort of saying at the frog's been sitting in meditation posture for a long time and still not enlightened. And similar with, Ajahn Chah sort of saying, yeah, well, chickens sit on their nests and for long periods of time. He hasn't seen any enlightened chickens yet. So that the actual posture isn't what is the purpose. The purpose is the alleviating of the hindrances or the understanding of the hindrances, and getting to have a recognition of how they hinder and how to free oneself from that. So then, so that's either within the posture one has to do something different.
So that that's where in that discourse that that the Buddha gives to Moggallana, I mean, there's a whole range of techniques that he gives, both in terms of how to apply the mind, whether one kind of strengthens the awareness on the meditation object, whether one directs one's attention to perception of light, whether one brings up a Dhamma theme to reflect it and investigate, and those are within the posture, or are within the mental application, or sitting there and pulling your ears that's one of the things the Buddha says to do. I mean, that's a physical way of getting out of the dullness and drowsiness, so that finding different techniques within the posture, whether internally in terms of mental application, or within the posture itself, maybe sometimes exaggerating the posture, sometimes using a hand mudra. Those are ways where you're sitting, or having to get up and go and do walking meditation, or go and, I mean, the Buddha actually said, you know, going out and looking at the sky, which will wake one up, whatever the sky is doing. I mean, in the sense, if it's a nice, clear evening, it should be sort of give some space. If it's raining, it'll sort of have a different, same effect, but different method. Oftentimes we tend to hunker down, especially if it's dark outside. Just going outside, doing walking meditation, and doing something like that. There's all sorts of ways, but trying to dispel the drowsiness. I can remember when I was living by myself on Tudong and out at Daodam. It was very isolated, living by myself, and if I'd be meditating late at night or something and start getting drowsy, having difficulty, and it's still not time to go to bed, I would force myself to go. I'd leave my flashlight at my kuti and then walk along the trail into the forest. And there was kind of a dropped off a cliff on one side, and it was down into a stream, a cliff. I mean, it wasn't that far, but that was, it wouldn't have been pleasant. I dropped down to the creek, and on one side was a forest rising up on the other side, so I could walk along, and it didn't take very long to sleepiness would be dispelled, come back and sit again. The main thing is that one's trying to find ways to dispel drowsiness, and the same goes with the other hindrances. Recognizing, okay, this is a hindrance. How do I work with it? What skillful means do I have? What did the Buddha advise, or what have the different teachers advised? But that's in terms of meditation, and particularly sitting meditation, it's important to put one's attention and effort toward that, and also one shouldn't feel kind of obligated that like sitting meditation is the only valid kind of way of practice. I mean, that's walking meditation, standing meditation, those are equally useful, equally valid, equally beneficial. The benefits of our meditation arise through a continuity of awareness, as opposed to having been able to sit for however long or whatever, how much time we've clocked and doing something.